I had a dream that fish could scream.
Come here, Squishy. Come here, little Squishy. Ow! Dory! That's a
jellyfish!
Bad Squishy! Bad Squishy!
Shoo! 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 Get me!
If Dory from Finding Nemo can feel pain, that pretty much settles it, right? Perhaps your dad told you that the fish can't feel the hook there in its mouth. Well, when fish are not being food, it looks like they have feelings. It's no dream. Squishy, emotional stuff. Must be the takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. We're feeling fish's pain on The Takeaway. It's Wednesday, May 6th. I'm John Hockenberry. I'm joined this morning by Farai Chidea. Good morning, Farai.
Hey, John. Coming up this hour, we're going to talk about why the U.S. is so focused on Pakistan when the rest of the world, well, isn't. And as you mentioned, new research shows that fish friends tend to feel pain. Does that change your take on sushi? Plus, the latest birth control shot, it's for the guys. Those stories coming up, but first, these headlines.
Find cash fast. That's what the Treasury Department is telling Bank of America. It says the bank needs almost $34 billion more to make it through the rest of the economic downturn. That's according to executives at the bank. Bank of America has already received $45 billion in TARP funds. President Obama holds trilateral talks with the leaders of Pakistan and Afghanistan at the White House today. Afghan Parliament member Khalid Pashtun says he has high expectations for the talks.
Hopefully, they will come up with some kind of tripartite solution between the U.S., Pakistan, and Afghanistan, because the Pakistan participation in the bringing peace to the region is extremely important.
The special envoy for the two regions, Richard Holbrooke, says Pakistan's political importance cannot be underestimated.
Our goal must be unambiguously to support and help stabilize a democratic Pakistan, headed by its elected president, Asif Ali Zardari.
Easier said than done. The talks come as tens of thousands flee the Swat Valley in Pakistan amid reports the government is mounting a new attack against militants in the region. Farai?
Well, in Afghanistan, the Red Cross confirmed that dozens of people, including women and children, died in coalition air raids in the western part of the country this week. American forces are investigating the incident, and Afghan President Hamid Karzai ordered an official inquiry yesterday. The U.S. Navy says it won't send a California-based ship on a planned humanitarian mission to the South Pacific. Now, one crew member has been diagnosed with H1N1, or the swine flu, and nearly 50 other sailors are showing symptoms. Meanwhile, there are now more than 400 confirmed cases in the U.S. in 38 states. Health officials in Texas have confirmed the second death of a U.S. person with swine flu. However, she also had a chronic health condition. And the Boston Globe doesn't have to stop the presses just yet. According to the Globe, its largest union reached a tentative deal with our partner, the New York Times Company, in the wee hours of the morning. The union agreed to massive pay cuts, unpaid furloughs, and changes in the lifetime job guarantee.
On Wall Street, the Dow and S&P were flat yesterday. The Dow opens at 8365. The S&P starts trading at 899, just a smidge under 900. Stress tests are supposed to test the state of your heart. Now they're being applied to banks. What else needs a stress test? Would you personally stress test something about yourself, your relationship, your marriage? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Your suggestions for other kinds of stress tests. How about your dinner plans?
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. It's Summit Day at the White House, and South Asia is on the agenda. Three players, President Obama, the leader of Pakistan and Afghanistan, all sit down to talk about strategic issues of mutual concern. During the 8 years of the Bush administration, it was easy to deal with Pakistan. There was a military strongman there. General Musharraf made it easy to project both strategic and domestic issues in the bilateral relationship. But Asif Ali Zardari, the popularly elected Democratic leader of Pakistan, is also weak, and unpopular in his own country. That complicates diplomacy, and here to talk about it is Jonathan Marcus, BBC diplomatic correspondent. He joins us from London. Jonathan, thanks for being with us.
Yes, hi. Good morning.
How does it challenge the Obama administration to get what it wants strategically in Pakistan when you have President Zardari so unpopular and a civilian leader as opposed to a military leader?
Well, first of all, I don't think, John, one should over-egg how good things were when there was a military regime in Pakistan. I mean, clearly, many of the problems that exist today have their roots during that period. I think the problem for the Americans now is that this comprehensive approach from President Obama that was unveiled just a short while ago in March, that began as an attempt to link Pakistan into the problems in Afghanistan, an awareness that you couldn't deal with the problems there without dealing with the insurgency in Pakistan and coming across the border as well. But I think in the very short space of just a few weeks, I think the focus has shifted much more to Pakistan itself and the intractability of the problems there. And although there is a democratic government, the army is still a crucial institution. And the problem for the Americans is to convince both the army and the government that the real challenge the country faces is from within, from the domestic insurgency, and not the external threat from a traditional enemy, India.
Well, making that argument late last month was Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Listen to this, Jonathan.
With this supplemental request, we are seeking funding of $497 million in assistance for our work in Pakistan, which will support the government's efforts to stabilize the economy, strengthen law enforcement, alleviate poverty, and help displaced citizens find safe shelter.
All domestic Pakistani concerns there, the Secretary of State is laying out. Is that the scale of the aid that's going to be required?
I think it's an indication of the scale of the problem, certainly. I think it's interesting that President Obama has set out his stall in Afghanistan and Pakistan, the idea that this is a war that America intends to win. But the phrase that you don't hear much coming from American spokesmen is nation building. But I think in reality, it's quite clear that there is a huge amount of nation building going on in Afghanistan, where the United States is a direct actor on the ground, but equally at one removed. And you heard there from the list of the menu, as it were, of things that the Secretary of State set out, nation building in Pakistan is equally important, albeit indirectly. The United States is not a direct player. But that, of course, speaks to the very long-term nature of the problem. And that is obviously a complicating factor, too.
You know, at some point, and you referred to this sort of implicitly in your opening statement there, Jonathan, the Bush administration had to essentially say, you know, Musharraf is too weak to be dealt with. Is there a point at which the Obama administration has to make the same kind of difficult choice about Zardari? And behind the scenes, Ashfaq Kiani, the military leader, is there and has enormous clout inside Pakistan.
Well, he has enormous clout, but it's not clear that the Pakistan military are any more enthusiastic about significantly confronting the insurgents than is the government. So that's a problem. I think, though, the Americans have to back the democratic leader that they have in place, and we heard that very clearly from Mr. Holbrooke, the administration's point man, yesterday. I think it's interesting, though, that they're not leaving any diplomatic stone unturned. You're seeing the Americans reaching out to the main opposition leader in Pakistan, Nawaz Sharif, also reaching out to Saudi Arabia, who widely seen as a backer of Mr. Sharif, but also a country which has some diplomatic clout and influence with Pakistan. So it's a comprehensive approach, if you like, from the White House on many, many tracks.
Indeed, Bob Gates is in Saudi Arabia, Secretary of Defense, actually pulling some of those levers. Finally, is the U.S. at odds with the rest of the world in assessing and declaring the significance of the so-called Pakistan problem?
I don't think it's at odds in terms of the assessment of the centrality of what's going on in Pakistan. Now, you can understand that's something we in Britain sense very strongly. We have a large community of people whose origins come from that part of the world. Also, of course, British security and intelligence people tell us that the vast bulk of potential terrorist attacks being planned for Britain emanate from that part of the world. I think that where there is something of a difference is the, if you like, the shrillness sometimes, the sense of impending catastrophe that one hears from Washington. I don't think that's entirely shared in London, in the Foreign Office and so on. I think there are certainly very strong concerns about stability in Pakistan, but as yet, no real alarm bells ringing that Pakistan is likely to go under. But that, of course, isn't to underestimate the scale of the problems involved.
Well, Well, we'll listen for the alarm bells at the White House later today. Jonathan Marcus, BBC diplomatic correspondent, talking about South Asia and the Pakistan-Afghanistan situation as leaders of Pakistan and Afghanistan sit down with President Obama at the White House today. Farhan?
Another big issue with international ramifications. The Justice Department has been investigating the lawyers who wrote the secret torture memos. They authorized brutal interrogations, including waterboarding, wall slapping, and head slamming. The final version of that investigation could be released late this month. Today, our partners at the New York Times report the Justice Department will recommend that the lawyers who wrote the memos should not be criminally prosecuted. Scott Shane is the national security reporter for the New York Times. So if the government does go ahead and say, hey, we're not going to prosecute you, what are the other options in terms of dealing with this?
Well, the most likely option is, assuming that this report ends up as critical as the early drafts appear to have been, is that they could recommend to state bar associations some kind of disciplinary action, ranging from a letter of reprimand or something like that, all the way to disbarment.
Now, there has been some action by the San Francisco Bay Area chapter of the National Lawyers Guild to really look at disbarment as a choice. But how big is that movement to really think about disbarring people like Haynes and you, who are some of the key people?
Well, this particular report focuses only on Justice Department employees and the three key people who were authors of these interrogation memos were John Yoo, who's now a professor at Berkeley, law professor at Berkeley, Jay Bybee, who's now a federal judge in Nevada, an appeals court judge, and Stephen Bradbury. Any of them could face some kind of sanction from this report. We were told that at least in an early draft, bar actions were recommended for John Yoo and Jay Bybee, but not for Stephen Bradbury. But this report, which has been in the works for 4 years, more than 4 years now, is still a little bit of a work in progress. It was the subject of a sort of tussle with the former Attorney General, Michael Mukasey, who was very unhappy with the draft. And now the new Attorney General, Eric Holder, still has to approve a final draft this month.
Well, I actually want to, you know, talk about how universities are responding to us. Here's a little bit of Condoleezza Rice confronted by students about the Bush policy choices.
Foreign policy is full of tough choices, very tough choices. The world is not a bunch of easy choices in which you get to make ones that always feel good.
I'm aware, but even in...
I'm sorry, we have to move on.
Well, this is a situation where a lot of these folks have gone in and out of academic context, including Rice, but also you. And there's a question always about whether student activism can help be one of these levers that raises questions. Is this important at all, or is it really just the politicians who have leverage?
Well, I think one thing that certainly John Yoo has found, and I think Condoleezza Rice is finding, is that this very emotional torture issue is very hard to escape. She made those remarks at a Stanford dorm, was sort of confronted by a student. That immediately went up on YouTube and went around the world. And then over the weekend, she spoke to a private school group in Washington, was confronted by a news team from Al Jazeera outside the talk, and again was sort of pressed on her role in approving these brutal interrogation methods. And for Mr. Yoo, there's been some effort to strip him of his tenure at Berkeley, which would be necessary if they were going to dismiss him. You know, it's not clear how any of that's going to end, but right. It certainly makes life uncomfortable for these folks.
All right, a multifaceted situation. Scott Shane, national security reporter for the New York Times. Thanks much.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.